"You cannot guess what I want," Paul said. And he thought, "I cannot back down. I must hold control over these people."
"You are Mudir of the Sandride this day," Stilgar said.
Cold formality rang in his voice.
"How do you use this power?"
"We need time to relax, time for cool reflection," Paul thought.
"We shall go south," Paul said. "Even if I say we shall turn back to the north when this day is over?"
"We shall go south," Paul repeated. A sense of inevitable dignity enfolded Stilgar as he pulled his robe tightly around him.
"There will be a gathering," he said. "I will send the messages."
"He thinks I will call him out," Paul thought, "and he knows he cannot stand against me." Paul faced south, feeling the wind against his exposed cheeks, thinking of the necessities that went into his decisions. "They do not know how it is," he thought, but he knew he could not let any consideration deflect him. He had to remain on the central line of the time storm he could see in the future. There would come an instant when it could be unraveled, but only if he were where he could cut the central knot of it. "I will not call him out if it can be helped," he thought. "If there's another way to prevent the jihad..."
"We'll camp for the evening meal and prayer at Cave of Birds beneath Habanya Ridge," Stilgar said.
He steadied himself with one hook against the swaying of the Maker, gestured ahead at a low rock barrier rising out of the desert. Paul studied the cliff, the great streaks of rock crossing it like waves. No green, no blossom softened that rigid horizon. Beyond it stretched the way to the southern desert, a course of at least 10 days and nights, as fast as they could goad the Makers. 20 thumpers. The way led far beyond the Harkonnen patrols. He knew how it would be. The dreams had shown him. One day, as they went, there'd be a faint change of color on the far horizon, such a slight change that he might feel he was imagining it out of his hopes, and there would be the new siege.
"Does my decision suit Muad'Dib?" Stilgar asked.
Only the faintest touch of sarcasm tinged his voice, but Fremen ears around them, alert to every tone in a bird's cry or a Cielago's piping message, heard the sarcasm and watched Paul to see what he would do.
"Stilgar heard me swear my loyalty to him when we consecrated the Fedaken," Paul said. "My death commandos know I spoke with honor. Does Stilgar doubt it?"
Real pain exposed itself in Paul's voice. Stilgar heard it and lowered his gaze.
"Usul, the companion of my siege, him I would never doubt," Stilgar said. "But you are Paul Muad'Dib, the Atreides Duke, and you are the Lizan al-Ghaib, the voice from the outer world. These men I don't even know."
Paul turned away to watch the Habanya Ridge climb out of the desert. The Maker beneath them still felt strong and willing. It could carry them almost twice the distance of any other in Fremen experience. He knew it. There was nothing outside the stories told to children that could match this old man of the desert. It was the stuff of a new legend, Paul realized. A hand gripped his shoulder. Paul looked at it, followed the arm to the face beyond it. The dark eyes of Stilgar exposed between filter mask and stillsuit hood.
"The one who led Tabor Siege before me," Stilgar said. "He was my friend. We shared dangers. He owed me his life many a time, and I owed him mine."
"I am your friend, Stilgar," Paul said.
"No man doubts it," Stilgar said.
He removed his hand, shrugged.
"It's the way."
Paul saw that Stilgar was too immersed in the Fremen way to consider the possibility of any other. Here a leader took the reins from the dead hands of his predecessor, or slew among the strongest of his tribe if a leader died in the desert. Stilgar had risen to be a naib in that way.
"We should leave this Maker in deep sand," Paul said.
"Yes," Stilgar agreed. "We could walk to the cave from here."
"We've ridden him far enough that he'll bury himself and sulk for a day or so," Paul said.
"You're the Mudir of the Sandride," Stilgar said. "Say, when we..."
He broke off, stared at the eastern sky. Paul whirled. The spice blue overcast on his eyes made the sky appear dark, a richly filtered azure against which a distant rhythmic flashing stood out in sharp contrast.
"Ornithopter."
"One small thopter," Stilgar said.
"Could be a scout," Paul said. "Do you think they've seen us?"
"At this distance, we're just a worm on the surface," Stilgar said.
He motioned with his left hand.
"Off! Scattered on the sand!"
The troop began working down the worm's sides, dropping off, blending with the sand beneath their cloaks. Paul marked where Chani dropped. Presently, only he and Stilgar remained.
"First up, last off," Paul said.
Stilgar nodded, dropped down the side on his hooks, leaped onto the sand. Paul waited until the maker was safely clear of the scatter area, then released his hooks. This was the tricky moment with the worm not completely exhausted. Freed of its goads and hooks, the big worm began burrowing into the sand. Paul ran lightly back along its broad surface, judged his moment carefully, and leaped off. He landed running, lunged against the slip face of a dune the way he had been taught, and hid himself beneath the cascade of sand over his robe. Now the waiting. Paul turned, gently, exposed a crack of sky beneath a crease in his robe. He imagined the others back along their path doing the same. He heard the beat of the thopter's wings before he saw it. There was a whisper of jet pods, and it came over his patch of desert, turned in a broad arc toward the ridge. An unmarked thopter, Paul noted. It flew out of sight beyond Habanya Ridge. A bird cry sounded over the desert. Another. Paul shook himself free of sand, climbed to the dune top. Other figures stood out in a line trailing away from the ridge. He recognized Chani and Stilgar among them. Stilgar signaled toward the ridge. They gathered and began the sandwalk, gliding over the surface in a broken rhythm that would disturb no maker. Stilgar paced himself beside Paul along the wind-packed crest of a dune.
"It was a smuggler craft," Stilgar said.
"So it seemed," Paul said. "But this is deep into the desert for smugglers."
"They've their difficulties with patrols, too," Stilgar said.
"If they come this deep, they may go deeper," Paul said.
"True.
It wouldn't be well for them to see what they could see if they ventured too deep into the south. Smugglers sell information, too."
"They were hunting spice, don't you think?" Stilgar asked.
"There will be a wing and a crawler waiting somewhere for that one," Paul said. "Weave spice. Let's bait a patch of sand and catch us some smugglers. They should be taught that this is our land, and our men need practice with the new weapons."
"Now Usul speaks," Stilgar said. "Usul thinks Fremen."
But Usul must give way to decisions that match a terrible purpose, Paul thought. And the storm was gathering.
When law and duty are one, united by religion, you never become fully conscious, fully aware of yourself. You are always a little less than an individual.
From Muad'Dib, The 99 Wonders of the Universe, by Princess Irulan. The smuggler's spice factory with its parent carrier and ring of drone ornithopters came over a lifting of dunes like a swarm of insects following its queen. Ahead of the swarm lay one of the low rock ridges that lifted from the desert floor like small imitations of the shield wall. The dry beaches of the ridge were swept clean by a recent storm. In the con bubble of the factory, Gurney Halleck leaned forward, adjusted the oil lenses of his binoculars, and examined the landscape. Beyond the ridge, he could see a dark patch that might be a spice blow, and he gave the signal to a hovering ornithopter that sent it to investigate. The thopter waggled its wings to indicate it had the signal. It broke away from the swarm, sped down toward the darkened sand, circled the area with its detectors dangling close to the surface. Almost immediately, it went through the wing-tucked dip and circle that told the waiting factory that spice had been found. Gurney sheathed his binoculars, knowing the others had seen the signal. He liked this spot. The ridge offered some shielding and protection. This was deep in the desert, an unlikely place for an ambush. Still, Gurney signaled for a crew to hover over the ridge, to scan it, sent reserves to take up station and pattern around the area, not too high because then they could be seen from afar by Harkonnen detectors. He doubted, though, that Harkonnen patrols would be this far south. This was still Fremen country. Gurney checked his weapons, damning the fate that made shields useless out here. Anything that summoned a worm had to be avoided at all costs. He rubbed the ink-vine scar along his jaw, studying the scene, decided it would be safest to lead a ground party through the ridge. Inspection on foot was still the most certain. You couldn't be too careful when Fremen and Harkonnen were at each other's throats. It was Fremen that worried him here. They didn't mind trading for all the spice you could afford, but they were devils on the warpath if you stepped foot where they forbade you to go. And they were so devilishly cunning of late. It annoyed Gurney, the cunning and adroitness in battle of these natives. They displayed a sophistication in warfare as good as anything he had ever encountered, and he had been trained by the best fighters in the universe, then seasoned in battles where only the superior few survived. Again, Gurney scanned the landscape, wondering why he felt uneasy. Perhaps it was the worm they had seen. But that was on the other side of the ridge. A head popped up into the con bubble beside Gurney, the factory commander, a one-eyed old pirate with full beard, the blue eyes and milky teeth of a spice diet.
"Looks like a rich patch, sir," the factory commander said. "Shall I take her in?"
"Come down at the edge of that ridge," Gurney ordered. "Let me disembark with my men. You can tractor out to the spice from there. We'll have a look at that rock."
"Aye."
"In case of trouble," Gurney said, "save the factory. We'll lift in the thopters."
The factory commander saluted.
"Aye, sir."
He popped back down through the hatch. Again, Gurney scanned the horizon. He had to respect the possibility that there were Fremen here, and he was trespassing. Fremen worried him, their toughness and unpredictability. Many things about this business worried him, but the rewards were great. The fact that he couldn't send spotters high overhead worried him, too. The necessity of radio silence added to his uneasiness. The factory crawler turned, began to descend. Gently, it glided down to the dry beach at the foot of the ridge. Treads touched sand. Gurney opened the bubble dome, released his safety straps. The instant the factory stopped, he was out, slamming the bubble closed behind him, scrambling out over the tread guards to swing down to the sand beyond the emergency netting. The five men of his personal guard were out with him, emerging from the nose hatch. Others released the factory's carrier wing. It detached, lifted away to fly in a parking circle low overhead. Immediately, the big factory crawler lurched off, swinging away from the ridge toward the dark patch of spice out on the sand. A thopter swooped down nearby, skidded to a stop. Another followed, and another. They disgorged Gurney's platoon and lifted to hoverflight. Gurney tested his muscles in his stillsuit, stretching. He left the filter mask off his face, losing moisture for the sake of a greater need, the carrying power of his voice if he had to shout commands. He began climbing up into the rocks, checking the terrain. Pebbles and pea sand underfoot, the smell of spice.
"Good site for an emergency base," he thought. "Might be sensible to bury a few supplies here."
He glanced back, watching his men spread out as they followed him. Good men, even the new ones he hadn't had time to test. Good men. Didn't have to be told every time what to do. Not a shield glimmer showed on any of them. No cowards in this bunch, carrying shields into the desert, where a worm could sense the field and come to rob them of the spice they found. From the slight elevation in the rocks, Gurney could see the spice patch about half a kilometer away, and the crawler just reaching the near edge. He glanced up at the coverflight, noting the altitude. Not too high. He nodded to himself, turned to resume his climb up the ridge. In that instant, the ridge erupted. 12 roaring paths of flame streaked upward to the hovering thopters and carrier wing. There came a blasting of metal from the factory crawler, and the rocks around Gurney were full of hooded fighting men. Gurney had time to think.
"By the horns of the Great Mother! Rockets! They dared to use rockets!"
Then he was face to face with a hooded figure who crouched low, Christknife at the ready. Two more men stood waiting on the rocks above to left and right. Only the eyes of the fighting man ahead of him were visible to Gurney, between hood and veil of a sand-colored burnous, but the crouch and readiness warned him that here was a trained fighting man. The eyes were the blue and blue of the deep desert Fremen. Gurney moved one hand toward his own knife, kept his eyes fixed on the other's knife. If they dared use rockets, they'd have other projectile weapons. This moment argued extreme caution. He could tell by sound alone that at least part of his sky cover had been knocked out. There were gruntings, too, the noise of several struggles behind him. The eyes of the fighting man ahead of Gurney followed the motion of hand toward knife, came back to glare into Gurney's eyes.
"Leave the knife in its sheath, Gurney Halleck," the man said.
Gurney hesitated. That voice sounded oddly familiar, even through a stillsuit filter.
"You know my name?" he said. "You've no need of a knife with me, Gurney," the man said.
He straightened, slipped his Christknife into its sheath back beneath his robe.
"Tell your men to stop their useless resistance."
The man threw his hood back, swung the filter aside. The shock of what he saw froze Gurney's muscles. He thought at first he was looking at a ghost image of Duke Leto Atreides. Full recognition came slowly.
"Paul," he whispered, then louder, "is it truly Paul?"
"Don't trust your own eyes?" Paul asked.
"They said you were dead," Gurney rasped.
He took a half-step forward.
"Tell your men to submit," Paul commanded.
He waved toward the lower reaches of the ridge. Gurney turned, reluctant to take his eyes off Paul. He saw only a few knots of struggle. Hooded desert men seemed to be everywhere around. The factory crawler lay silent with Fremen standing atop it. There were no aircraft overhead.
"Stop the fighting!" Gurney bellowed.
He took a deep breath, cupped his hands for a megaphone.
"This is Gurney Halleck! Stop the fight!"
Slowly, warily, the struggling figures separated. Eyes turned toward him, questioning.
"These are friends!" Gurney called.
"Fine friends!" someone shouted back. "Half our people murdered!"
"It's a mistake," Gurney said. "Don't add to it."
He turned back to Paul, stared into the youth's blue Fremen eyes. A smile touched Paul's mouth, but there was a hardness in the expression that reminded Gurney of the old Duke, Paul's grandfather. Gurney saw then the sinewy harshness in Paul that had never before been seen in an Atreides. A leathery look to the skin, a squint to the eyes, and calculation in the glance that seemed to weigh everything in sight.